KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A federal official tells NPR the White House is looking for replacements for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. We hear from a top Senate Democrat who wants to know why Hegseth shared attack details with family. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Pope Francis used to phone a tiny congregation in their Gaza church almost every night. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. His last call was Saturday. We visit that church as it joins millions around the world mourning the Pope's death. Also, Harvard sues the Trump administration, saying it's being punished for exercising its constitutional rights, and how a radicalized thief becomes a rebel leader in the latest season of Star Wars Andor. It's Tuesday, April 22nd. On this day in 1864, Congress passed a law allowing In God We Trust to be printed on coins. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Vatican says the body of Pope Francis will be moved tomorrow to St. Peter's Basilica for several days of public mourning. Roman Catholic cardinals have set the pontiff's funeral for Saturday. Pope Francis is the only pontiff to take the name of St. Francis of Assisi. He is the Roman Catholic patron saint of animals and ecology. NPR's Jeff Brady reports Francis also pushed for action on climate change during his 12-year papacy.
Pope Francis's 2015 climate encyclical did not mince words. Quote, "The earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth." The letter called on rich countries to help poorer ones and inspired new religious organizations focused on climate reform. Christiana Zinner is a theology professor at Fordham University.
The Catholic Church now has to be seen as an entity that is concerned about care for creation and people's faith lives together. I don't think that can be erased.
More than 8,000 families, schools, groups, dioceses, and other organizations have pledged to take actions in response to Francis's climate encyclical. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Harvard University is suing the Trump administration. This is to prevent the loss of more than $2 billion in federal funding. NPR's Janaki Mehta prepared this report.
The lawsuit alleges the government is trying to, quote, leverage to gain control of academic decision-making at Harvard. This comes after Harvard refused to comply with a long list of demands from the Trump administration to overhaul its admissions, hiring, and other policies, including diversity, inclusion, and equity programs. The administration fired back by freezing more than $2.2 billion in federal funding and threatening to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status. In the past week, it has also threatened to eliminate visas for international students at Harvard. Now, the nation's oldest university is taking on the White House in court. Harvard's president, Alan Garber, said the consequences of the Trump administration's attack would be, quote, severe and long-lasting. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
Four Democratic representatives have gone to El Salvador to check on the status of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. The immigrant was illegally deported from Maryland last month. The U.S. Supreme Court has ordered the Trump administration to facilitate his return. President Trump has failed to do so far, but is claiming Abrego Garcia is a criminal. Florida Congressman Maxwell Frost says Abrego Garcia's lawyers denied that, and he never got to demonstrate his innocence in court.
This isn't just about him. This is also about every single person in the United States. The Constitution applies to all people in our country. Due process applies to all people in our country. It's one of the things that sets our country apart.
Officials in El Salvador also rejected the four lawmakers' request to visit Abrego Garcia yesterday. You're listening to NPR. NPR has learned the White House may be looking for a new defense secretary. That's after Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth used the messaging app Signal to share sensitive information about U.S. military strikes on Yemen, this time with his family. This was the second time Hegseth used the Signal chat to do this, and it was on a personal cell. The White House has rejected this reporting as, quote, fake news. A note, NPR CEO Catherine Mart is also the chair of the board of the Signal Foundation, which supports the app. The Federal Trade Commission is suing ride-sharing company Uber. The FTC claims that Uber deceived customers about a subscription service known as Uber One. NPR's Bobby Allen reports.
The FTC says Uber automatically signed people up for a premium service known as Uber One. The lawsuit claims Uber never received some customers' consent, failed to deliver promised savings, and made it difficult for people to cancel. For instance, the FTC says Uber requires 12 different actions in the app to cancel and that it was impossible to opt out within 48 hours of a billing date. Regulators say such a process violates federal consumer protection laws. An Uber spokesman says canceling is clear, simple, and follows the spirit of the law. The FTC action comes as both Meta and Google are in federal court facing government lawsuits that could force the breakup of the companies. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Researchers with the European Space Agency are studying how to grow food in space. They want to send a small pilot food production plant to the International Space Station in 2 years. They'll experiment with growing food cells in space. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're waiting to see how, if at all, President Trump addresses the leadership at the Defense Department. In a moment, Democratic Senator Jack Reed calls for a wider investigation of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. First, we report on what the White House is doing.
One U.S. official tells NPR that the search is underway to replace Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Publicly, the president is standing behind him after a tumultuous week. Hegseth's office fired some of his aides. Then came revelations that the secretary shared details of impending airstrikes in Yemen again. NPR confirmed this second chat on the messaging app Signal, which included Hegseth's wife, his brother, and his personal lawyer. The first chat was with top officials and a journalist who was inadvertently included.
NPR's Quill Lawrence is here to tell us more. Quill, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So we'll note that you're reporting this story with our colleague Tom Bowman. What are you guys hearing?
Yeah, a U.S. official told us that the search has begun after this second round of headlines about Hegseth. I should add that the White House has said our anonymous source doesn't know what they're talking about. But at a Rose Garden event yesterday, the president stood firmly by Hegseth, at least publicly.
No, he's doing a great job. It's just fake news. They just bring up stories. I guess it sounds like disgruntled employees. You know, he was put there to get rid of a lot of bad people, and that's what he's doing.
Quill, that phrase, disgruntled employees. I think Hegseth used a similar phrase in his public remarks about this and referred to people who were fired in his office. What's he talking about?
Yeah, there were four senior advisors to Hegseth who left in just the past week. Former Defense Department spokesman John Elliott resigned last week and then published a quite extraordinary opinion piece calling the past month at the Pentagon a, quote, full-blown meltdown. and saying that this infighting is hurting President Trump. He served in Trump's first administration and appears to want to continue to serve. Three other Pentagon advisors, Colin Carroll, Dan Caldwell, and Darren Selnick, were escorted out of the Pentagon and accused of leaking information to the press. They then put out, as a trio, the three of them put out a joint statement on X saying that their dismissal was unconscionable and that they haven't even been told what they stand accused of leaking. They, all three of them, served in uniform. They say they understand the importance of information security. Caldwell and Selnick, notably, are longtime associates of Hegseth. They've worked with him over a decade back to when he was at Concerned Veterans for America, a policy group.
So I'm trying to figure out what all of this adds up to. The White House does appear to be backing Hegseth, but he's been revealed. NPR has confirmed the original New York Times report that there was a second chat group on Signal where he was sharing information about an impending attack.
Yeah, I mean, with the first chat group, it was against Pentagon policy to use Signal for that. There were a lot of security issues with it, discussing details of an attack hours before the bombs hit in Yemen. But the people in that chat were the vice president, the secretary of state, people who would need to know. This second group, it appears that Hegseth was just cut and pasting this actionable intelligence about U.S. strikes to his wife. I can't think of any conceivable need they would have to know this information. And military sources, veterans I talked to, are just outraged about this. They say that it really did put U.S. lives at risk and American security at risk. And they're concerned that this example being set, you know, the military really drills into troops that they have to take responsibility for their actions, own up. And so far, Hegseth has not done that yet for either of these Signal chats.
Yeah, and I guess we should emphasize Hegseth's side has insisted no classified information was shared, leaning on how they define classified information, but it was information about an impending attack, which is always considered sensitive. Quill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Pete Hegseth spoke about those chats this morning on Fox and Friends.
What was shared over Signal, then and now, however you characterize it, was informal, unclassified coordinations for media coordination and other things. That's what I've said from the beginning.
For more on this, we turn to Senator Jack Reed, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. He's calling for the Inspector General to widen an existing investigation and determine whether classified intelligence was shared. Senator Reed, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much, Lila.
So, as we just heard, the Trump administration denies any classified material was shared in either of the two Signal chats in which the defense secretary participated, but you aren't taking the administration at its word. Why?
Well, the information was highly sensitive about bombing runs, timing, information that was shared with our adversaries would have been put our pilots' lives at risk, and it's a very basic a mistake that no one in the military of any senior rank should make. I was opposed to Hegseth's nomination. That's why I fought vigorously against it, and we almost defeated it. But he's confirming now everything that we were saying. He does not have the experience to manage a major enterprise like the Pentagon. He does not operate according to the chain of command, in my view. He's got a cadre of old buddies around him. And ironically, this week he fired a lot of his old buddies. And so this is just a complete meltdown in the Department of Defense, and it endangers our national security.
Is the administration cooperating?
Oh, the administration is not cooperating, I don't think. Yet there are rumors that they're looking for someone else. If that's the case, they better send out someone who's a real professional with experience, maturity, judgment, appropriate temperament, and a profound commitment to the Constitution. Those are all things that are very suspect in Secretary Hegseth's behavior.
Do you have any clarity at this point on why Hegseth used Signal to communicate about these war plans to attack Houthi rebels in Yemen?
I don't have any particular insights. That's why we've asked the Inspector General to look at it. It would seem to me to be just, you know, convenience over national security, which is not the right priorities. To include his wife and his brothers and others in these conversations are absolutely inappropriate. To take his wife into meetings with senior officers from other nations, completely inappropriate. And it sends a very bad signal to all the men and women in uniform that he's going to play around cavalierly with intelligence information, but they're told that if they ever do something like that, they'd be put in prison. So this, don't do do what I do, but do what I say attitude is not good.
Now, has the Inspector General's office given you an indication that they will incorporate this second signal chat into their investigation of the first chat, the one in which the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic was mistakenly added?
No, not yet. We try to remove ourselves from this process because it has to be independent. We will try to clarify, probably by letter, the situation at this point. I would assume, though, that the IG operating in his just his own individual capacity would see this as something else he has to look at. It's virtually identical to the first incident.
The Senate Armed Services Chair, Republican Roger Wicker, joined you earlier this month in calling for the Defense Department watchdog to investigate. What are you hearing privately from your Republican colleagues on the Hill? Are they still confident about Pete Hegseth's leadership?
Oh, I think there's a great deal of anxiety and nervousness because, they've seen these displays and they've, we have an organization that is the largest organization in the United States, basically being run by someone whose previous experience running the Veterans Group virtually ended in bankruptcy. So, they're wondering, I think we're all wondering, is this going to be the same situation? It seems he has a lack of attention on details, and that is a critical shortcoming with the Secretary of Defense.
Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, ranking Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll note the CEO of NPR, Catherine Marr, also chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation.
A gunman who killed 23 people near the U.S.-Mexico border in 2019 has pleaded guilty. KTEP's Aaron Montes reports the shooter will now serve a life sentence in prison.
Yvonne Gonzalez sat across the room from her parents' killer. She did not look at him during her statement, sometimes peering at her notes.
It is not up to me to make you answer for your sins. I may never hear from you. But no one walks away from answering to God.
Outside the courtroom, she said she at first wanted prosecutors to pursue the death penalty, but like a majority of other families and victims, wanted the district attorney to bring the case to an end.
I have no more room for hate in my heart.
District Court Judge Sam Medrano sentenced the gunman, Patrick Crucius, to 23 consecutive life sentences in prison. Right before the attack, Crucius published an online screed saying his intent was to stop the Hispanic invasion of Texas. In 2023, a federal judge sentenced the shooter to 90 consecutive life sentences after he pleaded guilty to hate crimes and firearm violations. After his sentencing, Medrano said the shooter failed in his mission to terrorize El Paso, a border city across from Mexico. He said the community became a symbol of resilience overcoming hate.
Your name and your hate will be forgotten.
The district attorney's office offered a plea agreement for a life sentence without a possibility of parole after a majority of victims and families wanted the case to end rather than pursue capital punishment for years. Translators read out loud a statement originally written in Spanish from Olivia Rodriguez, who survived the attack that day.
Es un monstruo que debe pagar aquí en la tierra. He is a monster who must pay here on earth.
Crucius offered no apologies for his admitted actions nearly 6 years ago, but his attorney offered his condolences to the victims and families who lost loved ones. The district attorney's office said nearly 50 people signed up to offer impact statements. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Moltes in El Paso.
This is NPR News.
Government professor Stephen Levitsky has spent years studying how democracies die. On the next Fresh Air, he argues the Trump administration is pushing the U.S. towards a 21st century form of autocracy, where elections, opposition parties, and independent media still exist, but are weakened by the incumbent government's abuses of power. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From EBSCO, providing researchers with access to biomedical and healthcare literature reviews with the goal of helping them conduct thorough reviews in less time. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. For years, Star Wars has captivated audiences of all ages with epic action-adventure tales full of spaceship battles, lightsaber duels, and a touch of the supernatural.
Use the Force, Luke.
But the Star Wars spin-off series Andor is different. There's no Jedi Knights, no Darth Vader. It's a grounded story of ruthless officers of the Galactic Empire and rebels taking big risks to fight back.
I'd rather die trying to take them down than die giving them what they want.
The series stars Diego Luna as the thief-turned-rebel spy Cassian Andor. We sat down with the show's creator, the screenwriter and director Tony Gilroy for a preview of the show's second and final season.
The first season, it's the making of a revolutionary. It's someone who could care less about anything but themselves, who over the course of some months and a variety of really extreme circumstances becomes incredibly radicalized, and he has made a firm commitment. That's where we leave him at the end of season one. When we come back for season two, he's a leader now, and he's involved.
There's a scene in an early episode where Andor's talking to a frightened young woman who's just starting out as a rebel, and one thing that Cassian says to encourage her is that you are coming home to yourself.
The Empire cannot win. You'll never feel right unless you're doing what you can to stop them. You're coming home to yourself.
What qualities is he showing us in this moment?
It's really an important scene. It's a young woman who is about to betray a facility that she works on behalf of the rebellion, and her whole life is going to change completely. She'll be on the run for the rest of her life. And we know from season one just the incredible sort of stations of the cross that Cassian Andor has been through to get where he is. And now it's a year later. And when he's speaking to her, he's become an inspirational advocate for the rebellion. He's also reminding himself, I think, of this terrifying thing that he's about to do and how important it is. She says, you know, if I die tonight, was it worth it? And he says, you're at home with yourself. You're at peace with yourself. You know that the Empire cannot win. You know that this is something you have to do. You'll always be dissonant with yourself. So it was a really cool way to come back and start the show and say, oh, my God, look how different he is from where we left him. Yeah.
Because one of the other ways I was kind of looking at the scene, I saw it that way first, right? And then I thought about it, and I went back to look at it again. And I thought, well, you know, Cassian is a leader in this, right? So I kind of thought of it as like, well, you know, Cassian maybe is sensing fear in this woman, but he's got to get her through this because he needs her to do stuff to get the goal done. So on the flip side, I mean, would it be fair to call Cassian in that moment manipulative because he's got a goal and he needs to get her through this thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're making me very, very happy because every scene should do all those things that you're talking about. Yeah. I mean, there's a part of him that's like, I got to get this done. And he's been trained by Stellan Skarsgård, who is a revolutionary accelerationist. He's been building a rebel network. And
Luthen Rail, that's his character's name.
Luthen Rail, yeah. And he's the one who's recruited Cassian in the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
And he is nothing if not clear about the fact that the ends justify the means. He would very much say anything to any of his people to get them to do what they need. Cassian Andor is a much more fully realized, empathetic and soulful character. So the tension of what you're talking about is cool. That tension is going to be a lot of food for this second season. One of the problems for Luthen Rail is if you basically been building a startup company in his garage, if you've been building up a revolution in your garage, right?
Yeah.
How do you go public?
Yeah.
How do you take secrecy out into the world? I mean, how do you play with others? How do you manage your people without driving them crazy? He gives a big speech in episode 10 of season one where he reveals quite openly the sacrifices that he has made, and they are total.
I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see.
Not everybody can make that commitment.
Yeah.
Not everybody wants to make that commitment. And not everybody works at their best with that as the rules.
Yeah. You know what Andor does for me sometimes is that it gives, for me, the Rebel Alliance kind of a more Earth-like connection to rebellions that have happened on Earth here in our real history, and maybe understanding their purpose and what they're fighting for, and also weighing the cost of fighting oppression, fascism. So, I mean, how much does the real world's history go into your depictions of war and revolution in Andor?
Oh, utterly and completely. And I, like probably many people listening, I mean, I'm a history freak. I've spent an incredible amount of time reading about revolutions and studying history, you know, in an idiot kind of way, a dinner table kind of way, but really fascinated with it. And all of a sudden, here was an opportunity. I can cherry pick through 6,000 years of history. I mean, is it the Roman Revolution? Is it the English Revolution? Is it the Russian Revolution? Is it the American Revolution? All the things I know about the Haitian Revolution. I mean, is it Thomas Paine? Is it Toussaint Louverture? Is it Trotsky? Is it all of the things that I've accumulated that I, you know, you're not going to get those into a rom-com. You're not going to get them into an espionage. You're not going to get them into a Bourne movie. As much as anything, it's why I'm there.
But one of the things you mentioned there, so I read an interview you did with SFX magazine, and that with the success of Andor, you're kind of hoping, at least that's what you told the magazine, that you hope it might convince Lucasfilm to maybe break more ground with the Star Wars story. A three-camera sitcom, a horror film, or even a courtroom drama. I mean, what are you thinking about here? I mean, how...
All right, here's what I've learned. You know how you can't really do irony in print? Like, you really get in trouble. If you try to do irony in print, you get burned. You can't really riff on Star Wars. The Star Wars community is really hardcore, so riffing is not, like, that's an old conversation. It is the first thing I asked Kathy Kennedy in the very first blush after Rogue One, when everything seemed possible, what can we do? And I was like, well, what can you do? Could you do a courtroom drama? That would be really
right.
Fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And a horror movie. I think they might be even working on something like that. The three-camera show, I'm riffing. And I took, like, if you don't riff on Star Wars.
Well, Tony, I'm still going to hold out hope for the three-camera sitcom offshoot.
I will
Andor.
Come here first. I will definitely come to NPR and announce that.
Something like Curb Your Rebellion or something like that. I don't know. Something...
Oh, my God. Curb Your Rebellion. That's right. Oh, my God.
Tony Gilroy is the creator and executive producer of the series Andor, A Star Wars Story on Disney Plus. Tony, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Many political scientists are alarmed by the changes President Trump has made to the U.S. government since he took office.
We are no longer living in a liberal democracy.
The United States is moving in the direction of autocratization.
Into what's called competitive authoritarianism.
Checking in on the state of American democracy on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Cardinals meeting at the Vatican say the funeral for Pope Francis will be held Saturday in St. Peter's Square. It'll follow 3 days of mourning. Public viewing of the Pope's body is to begin tomorrow at St. Peter's Basilica. Francis died yesterday at the age of 88, one day after celebrating Easter Sunday. The Vatican says the Pope died of heart failure following a stroke that left him in a coma. Among those remembering Pope Francis is Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, who's praising Francis as someone who inspired hope and eased suffering. NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv says Ukrainians are offering mixed feelings about the Pope, who once suggested Ukraine should negotiate with Russia to end the ongoing war.
Zelensky met the Pope three times, though not in Ukraine. He posted a photo on social media of himself and the pontiff shaking hands. He prayed for peace in Ukraine and for Ukrainians, Zelensky wrote in the post. We grieve together with Catholics and all Christians who look to Pope Francis for spiritual support. The pontiff angered Ukrainians in 2024 when he told a Swiss broadcaster that Ukraine should, quote, have the courage of the white flag and negotiate with Russia. Ukrainians interpreted that as him telling them to capitulate to the Russians. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News. Police in Indian-controlled Kashmir are blaming militants opposed to Indian rule for what they're calling a terror attack aimed at tourists and other civilians. Multiple deaths and injuries are being reported today. That attack occurred as Vice President Vance is visiting the country. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments today in a case that tests whether school boards must provide opt-outs for children whose parents object to class material that violates their religious views. Here's NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Until now, the lower courts have largely deferred to school boards to determine what materials may be presented in the classroom. But in today's case, parents with conservative religious views want their elementary school children to be able to opt out of public school classes where books that feature some LGBTQ characters are occasionally discussed. Interestingly, of the 9 Supreme Court justices, only 3 were educated in public schools. The other 6 all went to private Catholic schools. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Harvard University is suing the Trump administration for freezing more than $2 billion in federal grants to the school. Harvard's president recently announced the school would not comply with the administration's demands to limit political activism on campus and to make broad policy changes. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Harvard is suing the Trump administration to stop it from taking away billions of dollars in research funding. Kirk Carapeza at member station GBH in Boston has been following this lawsuit and the broader White House crackdown against higher education, and he's with us now. Good morning, Kirk.
Hey, good morning.
So we know the Trump administration has been making demands of top universities, threatening their funding if they don't comply. And now Harvard's suing. Could you just put this suit into context for us?
Sure, this is the latest clash in what's really a broader culture war. The Trump administration is pressuring elite schools like Harvard and Columbia, calling for reform, slashing overhead costs, trying to tie their federal funding to hiring admissions and viewpoint diversity. And earlier this month, the administration demanded Harvard audit campus ideology and stop recognizing certain student groups accused of anti-Semitism. Harvard President Alan Garber, who was Jewish, refused. He called the demands illegal and unconstitutional. In response, the government froze more than $2 billion in grants, threatened to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status, and to limit its ability to enroll international students.
And now Harvard is suing. What is their legal argument?
So Harvard says the funding freeze is retaliatory and baseless. Its lawsuit argues there's no rational link between real anti-Semitism concerns on campus and life-saving research funding. In a message addressed to the Harvard community, President Garber said the government's actions will be, quote, severe and long-lasting. At this time, the White House has not responded to our request for comment.
And how is the campus reacting to Harvard suing?
Students and faculty are celebrating this decision. Government professor Ryan Enos says Harvard is uniquely positioned to challenge what he and many others see as Trump's authoritarian playbook.
What it takes is somebody that is willing to put the resources and the time, and Harvard has those things. And I think so many of us are proud that they're actually doing it.
Alumni are proud, too, and willing to support the fight financially. One alum who fears being targeted told me if Harvard can't use its $50 billion endowment to fend off these threats, then what is it good for? It's also worth pointing out that one of the reasons that Columbia, facing similar demands, did not sue last month was because its leaders feared the cost wasn't worth it in the long run.
Now, Kirk, you cover higher education. What does this fight say about academia right now?
Yeah, President Trump has long painted schools like Harvard as too elitist, too expensive, and too, quote unquote, woke. You know, he campaigned on that message. And surveys show many Americans agree with them. A recent Gallup survey found that while Americans broadly value college, the confidence gap is growing fast. A decade ago, only about 10% of Americans said they had no confidence in higher ed. Today, that number is closer to a third.
So why is public trust so low?
Yeah, Americans are worried about colleges pushing political agendas, not teaching relevant skills, and of course, the cost. So higher ed is facing these existential threats from every angle. Lynn Pascarella is the president of the American Association of Colleges and Universities. And she told me most schools can't afford to take on the government, but none of them can afford to remain silent given the circumstances.
Everyone needs to exercise moral courage at this time and defend not only higher education and its democratic purposes, but the values that we hold dear collectively in our society.
And just this morning, for the first time, her group and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences issued a joint statement with nearly 200 presidents signing on, condemning the administration's actions.
That is GBH's Kirk Carapezza. Thank you for your reporting, Kirk.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Many people around the world feel a personal connection to Pope Francis, and that includes people in the Middle East. He traveled to Iraq. He traveled to Persian Gulf nations. And there's one place where the Pope maintained a special connection even when he was deathly ill. NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, and Jane Araf prepared this report.
Yusuf.
Buonasera, Santo Padre.
Buonasera, come stai?
This is Pope Francis in a WhatsApp call in January to the Holy Family Church in Gaza City.
Cosa avete mangiato oggi?
He's speaking to Father Yusuf Assad, a priest there. He asks what he ate. The call was during a lull in fighting between Israel and Hamas, and things were better. 3 months later, the ceasefire is broken and famine is setting in. But on that day, the congregation had chicken wings. Francis ends by saying they would talk tomorrow. 300 people have sheltered inside the last remaining Catholic church in Gaza since the war began. The Pope, head of 1.4 billion Catholics around the world, called every evening to see how they were. The last time was Saturday, 2 days before he died, says George Anton, a Holy Family parish spokesman. Anton says Francis asked them to pray for him and to not be afraid. that he was with them. Outside the church, a group of children play soccer. Inside, Anton tells producer Anas Baba, there's a huge feeling of loss. Today, we feel like we're truly orphans, Anton tells him. He says no matter where he was or what he was doing, Francis would call every evening at 7. He would ask whether we had food, did we have clean water, had anyone been injured. It was the questions a father would ask, Anton says. We lost all of this. But that's not all they lost with the death of Pope Francis. The Gaza war has raged for a year and a half. At least 1,600 Israelis have been killed. The Israeli response has killed more than 51,000 Palestinians and destroyed the Palestinian enclave. The war rarely makes headlines anymore. But Pope Francis never let it drop.
E in modo particolare alla comunità cristiana di Gaza.
The day before he died, he brought up Gaza in his Easter address at the Vatican, read by his deputy. He called for a lasting ceasefire. He was the only voice that did not go silent, says Anton in Gaza. There are fewer than 700 Christians left in Gaza, a region that was home to the beginning of Christianity. Anton says Pope Francis was concerned with all Palestinians. Producer Bob asks him if there's anything he'd like to say in English. Anton says Pope Francis believed Gazans deserve dignity and independence.
I would call the whole world and every individual on this earth to see Gaza by the eyes of Pope Francis.
A pope who forged a personal and lasting connection with a tiny community in the midst of war. With producer Anas Baba in Gaza, I'm Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
This is NPR News.
In her new book, journalist Jean Carstensen recounts watching a boat filled with refugees capsize off the coast of Greece in 2015. Next time, Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. Most people celebrate their birthdays with cakes and candles. NASA's oldest serving astronaut, Don Pettit, celebrated his 70th birthday this weekend by undocking from the International Space Station and dropping down to Earth. He'd been up there for over 7 months and says while other astronauts can quickly go out, eat pizza, and dance, it usually takes him about 24 hours to feel human again when he gets home. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. More than 40% of women have dense breast tissue, which puts them at higher risk for developing cancer and for cancer to be missed on mammograms. Testing can reveal this issue, but many aren't sure what to do with the diagnosis. Here's NPR's Yuki Noguchi.
A Pittsburgh woman named Joy remembers her own mother diligently getting her cancer screenings.
She had her mammograms every year.
But like Joy, her mother had dense clusters of glands and tissue in her breasts. That likely obscured the tumors on her 2D black and white mammograms until it was too late.
She was diagnosed at age 43, and by 48 she was gone.
So when Joy herself turned 43, she enrolled in a breast imaging study. Her mammograms found nothing, but researchers followed up with high contrast images and told her,
"We think we see something."
Joy did have cancer, but it was caught early enough to remove it completely. Joy didn't want to share her full name because she hasn't discussed her diagnosis widely with colleagues, but she wanted to share her story to advocate for easier access to follow-up MRIs for women with dense breasts.
I think it should be more automatic.
Getting follow-up images is usually not easy. MRI machines are in short supply, and out-of-pocket costs for an MRI can cost as much as $1,000, says Krissa Smith, vice president of education at the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation.
Costs is the biggest barrier, and most of the supplemental imaging is not covered by insurance.
Smith says family history, weight, and lifestyle can factor into one's risk, so it's best to talk to a doctor.
It really has to be a conversation with your doctor, because if you have other risk factors, a family history of breast cancer, that's going to be a more targeted conversation for you and what you need.
Dr. Wendy Berg did that a decade ago.
When I had put in my own risk factors into the risk models and determined that I, in fact, was high risk, and I knew I had dense breasts, I contacted my doctor and I said I would like to get a screen MRI. And he said, "Well, remind me why you want to do that."
Berg researches radiology and breast imaging at the University of Pittsburgh. One of the biggest problems, she says, is many doctors themselves are not familiar with the latest science. According to Berg's own findings, mammograms can detect, on average, 5 cancers in 1,000 patient scans. Ultrasounds can catch 1 or 2 more.
We added a screening MRI and found another 15 cancers per 1,000, even after the mammogram and ultrasound.
Yet, because of cost, complexity, or lack of awareness, Berg says fewer than a tenth of eligible patients get follow-up MRIs. Berg is also chief scientific officer of densebreastinfo.org, an educational website. She says she benefited from her own advice with the MRI she pushed her doctor for 10 years ago.
As luck would have it, that MRI showed a small invasive cancer that is not visible and is not visible in retrospect on my mammogram.
Berg says women need to push their doctors and insurance companies.
It remains incumbent on the woman herself to look at her risk factors, to talk to her doctor and say, "Hey, I'd like to get an MRI." Don't wait for them to recommend it to you.
For the many women with dense breasts, it could be a lifesaver. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Thank you. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. In Syria's civil war, emergency responders wearing white helmets came to the world's attention by running into harm's way to rescue civilians. They were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize and featured in an Oscar-winning documentary. Now, with Syria's dictator Bashar al-Assad gone, the white helmets have a new challenge. NPR's Lauren Freyer takes us to a fire station in Damascus, sirens and all.
Oh, wow, this is all burned. So we're rushing into this building. Emergency here.
Firefighters rush into a burning building in the Syrian capital. Firefighter Tariq Talib says they managed to extinguish the flames in time and no one was injured. Residents are gobsmacked. They got here so quickly and they didn't ask for any bribes, says Mohammed Bassem Saeed, a retiree who lived through Syria's civil war and says he never got help like this. These new firefighters wear gold and navy uniforms and iconic white helmets. For most of the war, the white helmets operated only in rebel-held areas. Dictator Bashar al-Assad had decked the capital with billboards vilifying them as traitors and terrorists. I never believed any of that, though, Saeed says, thanking the firefighters profusely.
Thank you.
When Assad fell in December, a white helmets convoy rolled south from rebel territory and into Damascus. I felt joy, grief, and shock all together, says Amr Zarife, a white helmet who's from Damascus but hadn't been here since 2018 when he responded to a chemical weapons attack by Assad's forces. Now he lives in a Damascus firehouse where the white helmets have set up new headquarters. Their founder, Ra'id Saleh, is now in Syria's cabinet. And the volunteer force he founded 12 years ago is extending its reach for the first time to the entire country.
It's the journey of the Syrian people and the Syrian revolution.
Deputy leader Farouk Habib says their workload has actually quadrupled, even though the war is over.
Most of our country is destroyed. Half of our people lost their homes and they are displaced either internally or they became refugees. And now our main mission is to deal with the legacy of the war, help to find the missing persons. We're dealing with the mass graves, cluster munition.
They're also repairing roads and water pipes. These are people who started as shopkeepers, teachers, gas station attendants, and engineers. Habib was a banker.
I was a regional manager at a private bank in Syria. When the revolution started, some people carried guns, some people left, and some people volunteered.
In the opposition-held Northwest, the white helmets served about 5 million people. Habib says they're now stretching to eventually meet the needs of more than 20 million Syrians. Even as their budget is cut, USAID, the foreign aid agency dismantled by the Trump administration, it used to be the White Helmets' biggest funder.
Hello. Hey, Habib.
Dispatchers are nevertheless still managing to coordinate an average of 15,000 operations per month. Once volunteers, the White Helmets now get salaries. They're even recruiting former regime firefighters into their ranks, including at least one at this firehouse who's working for free. He's so eager. Many of the White Helmets actually started as recipients of the group's services. Mustafa Bakar ran a butcher's shop and had never heard of the White Helmets before he found himself in the back of one of their vans, bleeding from shrapnel and being ferried to safety. He told himself if he survived, he would join them. And that was 10 years ago. As Bakar describes the trauma of these past 10 years, of war and atrocities and of paying it forward and saving other people, he gets an emergency call. And a glimpse at what peacetime Syria could be like.
Cat stuck in a tree.
It's a cat stuck in a tree. The woman on the phone is frantic. And just like in any other crisis, the White Helmets respond. Part of our work is psychological support for the public, Bakar says, as he suits up to run down to the trucks. This whole country has PTSD, he says.
Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Damascus.
One thing NPR does for you is pay sustained attention to the news. We return to stories after the TV cameras and social media manipulators move on. And that includes this follow-up on Hurricane Helene. When it flooded much of North Carolina last year, people found aid in a park. Laura Hackett of Blue Ridge Public Radio returned there.
Marco Rosenbrook is showing off the new garden in Swannanoa's Grovemont Park.
Over here, there are double white ones and double pink ones. And there are combinations of all kind of varieties in this flower bed.
These are all tulips, peonies, and daffodils, planted after Helene swept through this community of 6,000. For Rosenbrook, getting the bulbs in the ground was a way to lift his neighbor's spirits.
Flowers give hope. When you plant them, you don't know what's coming out. But when you see them in spring, you'll get happy. Because the planting a bulb is believing in tomorrow.
The flower aficionado and Dutch immigrant has worked in the tulip trade for decades, so he asked a company from the Netherlands for a few boxes of tulips. What he got was thousands of bulbs.
We have done it with volunteers. All the materials are for free, and we make the beauty here.
On a bench nearby, Claire Du Place watches her six-year-old son, Quinn, frolic around the park. It's her first time here since Helene, and she says seeing the flowers was a real moment for her.
It feels extra special with everything that we've been through with Helene, to see that level of intention and beauty and care that someone took the time to do.
Swannanoa is still hurting. Their post office and grocery store are gone, and many homes are still damaged. Duplace says it's hard to keep up hope, but the tulips are a reminder.
Every day you're seeing the devastation, but you're also seeing like everything that's been done and cared for.
For Rosenbrook, the beauty of his tulip project runs deeper than just appearances.
After the storm, we figured out that community is the basics of everything. People are willing to help each other and to make beauty. Isn't that where humanity is meant to be?
Those in Swannanoa now have a colorful reminder of that generosity. Each spring when the 10,000 flowers in Grovemont Park blossom. For NPR News, I'm Laura Hackett in Swannanoa, North Carolina.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
You do something to me, something that simply mystifies me. Tell me, why should it be? You have the power to hypnotize me. Let me live 'neath your spell.